The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 18, 2023. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. It's really nice to see you here this morning. Always nice to see people sitting sesshin, sitting here now. That's what our practice is, to be here now. And when we sit sesshin, I think you really, that becomes very clear to you. Sesshin is sort of like our everyday life in a way, super amplified, so we can see what it is that's taking place. And when you're at a sesshin, there's just this. There's just this. And you can notice when you get caught up in concerns you have. And you start to realize that those are just concerns, you know, that they're not really the thing we take them to be, which is reality. Reality's got to, we come back, here we are. And I remember that from my first sesshin. Really that strong sense of, here I am. And I would get lost out there. But I wasn't lost out there, I was right here, you know, so sesshin really helps us to see that. And also, what you really see is we're doing that with others. So you start to realize that that realization is not solipsistic, it's not just about me, I'm just worried about this stuff. You realize that being here now and not getting caught up in our ideas about here now is taking care of others. And when you sit with others, this becomes clear. When you sit with others for a couple days, it becomes really, really clear. You're taking care of everyone who's in the room. You're taking care of the entire situation, as well as watching your own mind. And you're taking care of the situation by watching your own mind. And then by coming together, we're helping each other with that realization. You know, again, when we go out into the world, we're surrounded by people. So people are our practice. And we are helping one another by sitting together. We're helping each other with that realization. So it always gives me joy to see people sitting sesshin. There are other things you could be doing. I don't know what. I mean, you could probably come up with the list, but here you are. Here you are. So to me, it's a great act of generosity. And thank you for being so generous. So today I'm going to give a talk. I've been giving talks from Steve's book, Buddhism Is Not What You Think, in the sessions that I've been leading for a while, and today will not be an exception. So I'm going to give a talk. The title of the chapter I'll be talking about in this collection is called The Most Valuable Thing in the World. And when I start these talks, I always like to just stop at the title and think about what it is that the title conjures for us as we're moving into the piece. I know that as a composition instructor, I would tell my students to remember to put a title on their papers constantly. And a title is not essay or essay number one. That's not a title. So I would tell them to come up with a title, because a title is the handshake of what it is that's going to follow. It's like an essay saying, hi, here I am. Here's who I am, right? To say, I'm from Cleveland and I sell, I don't know, furniture, whatever it is. But it's that introduction. So we have the most valuable thing in the world. That's the introduction to this chapter. And I don't know about you, but you see that and you go, wow. Now, if you have been taking up this practice, perhaps you start to have different ideas about what they might mean. But we just think about conventional ideas of what are we talking about when we talk about the most valuable thing in the world. If you were to ask your friend, Marcia, what's the most valuable thing in the world? You know, Marcia might go, I don't know, like a diamond that's the size of my fist. Do you know what I mean? You think about something like that. That'd probably be pretty valuable. Maybe a skyscraper, one of those mile-high skyscrapers, fancy skyscrapers. It's probably worth a lot of money. It's probably pretty valuable. Got a lot of high tech in it. You know, maybe you're thinking it's an investment opportunity. That's the most valuable thing in the world. Now, I'm sticking in the money scheme of things. And we might not, that might not be interesting to us. Yeah, whatever. Most valuable thing in the world to me is the second movement from Beethoven's 15th string quartet, that adagio. That is the most valuable thing in the world. Maybe your children are the most valuable thing in the world for you. Maybe love is the most valuable thing in the world for you. So happiness or peace. But what's interesting is at some point we start to think about what it is. We start to answer a question, what is the most valuable thing in the world? We start to answer that and we put something there where that question is. And then that drives us. Now, it might not be that thing we think is the most valuable thing in the world. That might not be what seems to be driving us. So you might say it's that diamond that's the size of your fist. And you probably go, well, I don't spend the rest of my life trying to get the diamond that's the size of my fist. But what you're doing is you put something there. What is the most valuable thing in the world? Boom. And it's that little boom. That's what we're trying to get. That little thing that we put. It's actually a big thing that we put there. But it might be a quiet thing. It might be an invisible thing, but it's there. And that drives us. We search for it. We're looking for it. Even the desire not to desire the most valuable thing in the world. That might be to us the thing that's the most valuable thing in the world. We had something like that. Vince Parr, a Sangha member who's a psychologist who was visiting from Florida, gave a talk. And in his talk, he basically asked a question like that. What is the thing you want the most in the world? And people are coming up with things like, I want to not want something wonderful. And you know what I mean? So you can hear, there's the boom. Just that's the thing. That's the thing I want. And we can do that with this practice as well, with the desire not to desire the most valuable thing. It's just putting something in that place. What is the most valuable thing in the world? And then there we are. Now, there's something, if we look at, you know, we hear a question like that, you might go, well, that's kind of a leading question. Because you realize, you're talking about the Buddha Dharma, that you can just sort of look at the terms in here and understand that the question seems to be coming from a relative reality. It doesn't seem to be coming from a sense of absolute truth. It seems to be coming from something that our business as usual, you know, that it's just the common world in a manner of speaking. Because if we look just at the, you know, the most valuable thing, well, now we've got most valuable. So most valuable has in it some kind of judgment that there's the most valuable thing, and then there's maybe like a pretty valuable thing, and then there's maybe just like a valuable thing, and then there's maybe stuff we don't think is valuable at all. So in most valuable, you start to hear we already have a way of understanding life in terms of something that's good, something that's bad, something that's better. And that is probably pretty recognizable for us that we do that. Just think about the consumer world we live in. I think it was, I was telling somebody, I remember a comedian saying this, I guess it was Louis C.K. And his question was, why do we need the best stereo? Why do we need the best blender? Why do we need the best, you know, everything's got to be the best. I have a friend who has a stereo system that is so good that when he posted on Facebook that he got it, and he lives in a condominium outside of, in Skokie, Illinois, which is just outside of Chicago. And his friend said, wait a minute, you've got, I don't know what it is, I'm going to make up a name for it. You've got a tower of power in a condominium? You know, it's a sound system that is probably the best. But he's living in a condominium. There are other people around him. He can't really let it loose the way that that thing's designed to be let loose. But he's got the best. You know, so that is a very common way we have. We want the best experience that we want. So most valuable puts us in that familiar world of evaluating, making things better than the other. Thing, the most valuable thing. We got things. Things are of this common way of understanding reality. If you've encountered these teachings, I think we all have, we know that what the teachers point out to us is those things we think we have aren't really the things we think we have. They don't have the thingness that we ascribe to them. So we've got most value, we've got thing, and then the clincher is in the world. In the world. Here we are in this relative world. Now, I want to make clear that I'm not saying don't evaluate. You're going to do it. We judge all the time. It happens like that. You know, notice you're doing it. So this is the thing about, hanging on to what's the most valuable thing in the world. Oh, it's the desire not to desire the most valuable thing in the world. Are you being honest at that moment? Can you see what's really taking place? Because my guess is if you were to dig past that, there's something under that that you really value. And our practice then isn't to shed valuing things. It's not to get rid of that. It's to see we're doing it. It's to really see we're doing it, that we do it all the time, like that. To see that you're doing that. It might even show up as, I don't value things. Because in your head, the other part of that is, because I know that valuing things isn't that valuable. You know, that the best thing to do is not to value things. So I'm not saying get rid of that, get rid of things. Here they are. Things are showing up, but they're not the things we think they are. They don't have that thingness that we ascribe to them. Notice, though, there's a thing. I'm hanging on to it. That's what happens with things. When you got a thing showing up, guess who's in the picture? You are in the picture. And this is important, again, for us to realize that ego self, that sense of a self that's separate from the world, is showing up. Because that ego self will cause us all kinds of problems. That ego self is the self that values and then wants the things that are the most valuable things. So are we trying to get rid of that ego self? No. You have to see the ego self is showing up to see what's showing up right now. Our practice is to be here right with what it is that's showing up. So is the ego self showing up? Well, you got a thing? Yep, ego self is showing up. That's living in this world. We live in this world. Things are going to show up. We're going to make something out of it. There we are making something out of it. You know, the whole thing, that's living in this world of muddy water. That's where we are. We're not out of it. We're here right in it. So it's really to be aware of what it is that's showing up. That's all in the title. That's just the title. I didn't even start reading the essay for you yet. So let's start reading the essay. Steve gets right to the heart of the matter. I don't know if you remember this particular chapter, but once I started reading it, I went, oh, I remember this. It starts with something like a koan. It goes like this. A student went to the Zen teacher Cao Shan and asked, what is the most valuable thing in the world? Cao Shan replied, the head of a dead cat. Why is the head of a dead cat the most valuable thing in the world? Asked the student. Because no one can name its price, said Cao Shan. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. A lot of good things going on here, so I'm going to spend some time with this. But first of all, I just want to tell you, one of the things I like to do is when I see a story like this, Steve doesn't always tell us where he gets his stories from. So sometimes you have to do some search. And I looked, and I'm still not 100% sure where this is from, other than I know one place it is. This is why I'm not sure that's the only place, because it seems like it's already quoting something else. But in the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of koans, in the commentary to the Blue Cliff Record, so a teacher had collected these koans or teachings. They're like we heard here. They're usually between a master and a student or two masters or two students, and they have a degree to which something surprising happens. Something that helps us to see we're trying to grab hold of something. So anyhow, in the Blue Cliff Record, there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes along with that teaching to help elucidate or illuminate the teaching. And one of the things they do is before the koan, they have something they call a pointer, which sometimes is in poetic form and sometimes it's not, but it wants to help you to see what it is the koan's pointing to. If you've ever read the Blue Cliff Record, you know that that pointer is actually a lot harder to understand than the actual koan is. You read it and you go, what are they talking about? Because it's usually filled with allusions. So it's just like one allusion after another, and that's the sentence, is a whole bunch of stuff you probably have never read before. And then you get to the koan. And then after the koan, you get some commentary. And then there's, and sometimes there's commentary on the commentary. And then there's a poem, and the poem sort of expresses what everything has been about so far. And then there's commentary on the poem. So it can have all these parts to it. So I'm saying that because the dead cat story is in the commentary to the first case of the Blue Cliff Record. The first case of the Blue Cliff Record, in case you're curious which one that is. I was. I just went, oh, which one is that? It's Bodhidharma's Clear and Void. And I think we most, those of us at Dharma Field, might most recognize that particular koan as the koan when the Emperor of China asks Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma was the figure who purportedly brought Chan Buddhism, the kind of Buddhism that is about direct experience. He brought that teaching to China in roughly the 5th century. And so the emperor asked him, he asked Bodhidharma, who are you in front of me? You remember the answer, Catherine?
No.
Yeah, that answer is pretty striking. Do you remember it, Rick? Who are you in front of me, the emperor asks. That's okay if you don't remember. It's just, it's one of those things sometimes you do, you know, just because of what the answer is. Bodhidharma said, I don't know. You know, which is like, what? The emperor is asking you who you are, and then he says, I don't know. But again, there's something going on in these koans, in these kinds of stories, that is worth paying attention to, and I'll help you see that in a second. But first, I just want to tell you who the character, so we have two characters. We have a student, we don't know who that is. But then we have this master, and it's Cao Shan. And Cao Shan is a very important figure in the lineage of Buddhism that we practice, in the lineage of Zen that we practice. His Japanese name is Sozan. And his teacher was Tozan. Tozan was a great master, and sometimes I write down who some of his students were. Clearly Sozan was one of his students. Sozan was the student of Tozan. And together, so we practice Soto Zen. It's Sozan and Tozan. Soto. So they are the people who came up with the ways of study and practice that are our way. And that's who this Zen master is at this point. So then he gets this question, what is the most valuable thing in the world? And that could sound to us like a fairly naive question. You know, what's the most valuable? Who talks like that? Do you know what I mean? What's the most valuable thing in the world? And I would just caution you, only because I know that for a long time I took these questions as the most naive questions that were being asked, and you just go, the masters had such patience, such forbearance that they could put up with these questions. But know that when there's a koan that's being recorded, there might be somebody asking a naive question. It's possible. And I would say that if the student is said to be new to the practice, it could be they're trying to signal that this is a very naive question. But usually these are conversations about reality, about ultimate reality, about realization. So when you get a question like, what is the most valuable thing in the world? It's not that simple, childish question, what's the most valuable thing in the world? Is the teacher going to tell me it's a peach? You know, what is it going to be? The student understands something about the nature of reality already. Maybe they haven't fully penetrated it, but they've encountered these teachings and they know something about the nature of reality. They know that asking what is the most valuable thing in the world is actually an impossible thing to answer in a way. They know that. That's what the question is meant to do. What is an enlightened teacher going to say in response to the question, what's the most valuable thing in the world? Because in a way, everything is the most valuable thing in the world, right? I'm reminded of that story of the butcher shop, if you've heard it. It's a Zen story where a customer comes in and tells the butcher, I want your best cut of meat. And the butcher replies, well, they're all the best cut of meat. To which we could go, okay, well, he's just, you know, it's like an advertisement. Here at Joe's meat shop, every cut of meat is the best cut of meat. But if it's a Zen story, it's trying to tell us something else. It's helping us to see that, indeed, everything is the best cut of meat. It is the best cut of meat it can be. Everything is doing its best, to quote Norm. I love that. What's your practice? Our practice is doing our best. And that's what everything is doing. Everything is doing its best. Even when it looks like it's maybe not doing so well. It's doing its best. Conditions are such, it's doing its best. Every cut of meat, it's doing its best. And when you think about that, then you realize, in a way, none are best. I mean, if everything is best, doesn't best seem to imply? So if you got like 12 sausages and you go, all 12 sausages are the best. You know, there's not, it gets rid of the concept of best. It doesn't mean that the 12 sausages are mediocre or bad. It just means that that whole concept of best doesn't make any sense. It does not apply. So when we're talking about the best, we're just saying nothing could be better than this. Nothing could be better than this. Here it is. Again, our Sesshin practice. We think about, I don't know, getting out of here. But here we are. Right here we are. And that's what the student is engaging with. That's what he wants. Knowing that, now he's going to ask the teacher, what is the most valuable thing in the world? What is a teacher going to say? Sit back and listen. And what does the teacher say? The head of a dead cat. I mean, what a great response. Right, that just gets any preconceived notions you have in your head out right there. Because you might be going, I know what he's going to say. He's going to say enlightenment or something like that. But the teacher goes right for not what you're expecting, the head of a dead cat. And then we've got the student, of course, wondering why the head of a dead cat. Why is that the thing you pick? And the teacher says, again, something that's kind of surprising, but I think we can kind of get a sense of what he's talking about. He says, because no one can name its price. Okay, now I got it. Because what would be the price of the head of a dead cat? Who'd want to buy it, right? So how do you even put a price on that? It is something that you can't actually put a price on. You could say it's priceless. When we say priceless, we're usually talking about something we think is so valuable. Oh my God, that's priceless. Sometimes we're not. Sometimes, again, it's like, I don't know, a sunset. You know, isn't that like credit cards do something like that? Experience, priceless. You know, whatever. The vacation, $3,000. The experience, priceless. You know, so we think of priceless as something that we really value yet. We're still in that game of something that is just so worth something. It's so valuable, it's priceless. You couldn't pay enough for it. Well, here we got the opposite. You wouldn't pay anything for this, right? And that is eye-opening, because that's helping us to see something about priceless. First of all, it's helping us to see something about value, to help us understand value. Like the head of the dead cat, who's going to pay anything for it? This is the notion of value. Value, we think something is inherently valuable. Say that diamond that I was talking about, that fist size. We go, that is worth something. I don't care if it's the most valuable thing in the world or not. I know that's valuable. Well, it's only valuable because people think it's worth something. Does that make sense? Otherwise, it's just a pretty rock. But the value that it has that value because we ascribe to it, because somebody's willing to pay for it. There's something about value that's not absolute. It's an exchange value. So when I was a young man, just moved to the Twin Cities, one of the things I was pretty excited about, and I will tell you, this is a preference, I did not read a lot of comic books when I was a kid, but I read some. Mad Magazine was one, Crack Magazine, Crazy Magazine, Sick Magazine, all the Mad Magazine knockoffs. And then I bought this comic called Howard the Duck, which was pretty wild comic. And I wanted number one. I had all the other issues, and I wanted number one. But back then, this is 1982, so this is 40 years ago, Howard the Duck was going for $100, which is about $300, for one comic. And I didn't have a lot of money. I was just like, that's too rich for my blood. But for years, I kept thinking, boy, I'd get a job and I'd be like, I should save up for that Howard the Duck. That'd be pretty cool to have that. I even had a reprint of it. I had there was a giant version of it. I had that, but I wanted that original. Now you can get it for like $16 or $10. And imagine if I'd put that money in there. Because at that time it had value. And now it really doesn't have any value to it. Because that stuff, the value of this world, doesn't have ultimate meaning to it. And it's hard for us to see that sometimes. Because sometimes you go, well, how would that not have value? But just know, we're just talking about things that we've ascribed having value. So that story of the headless cat helps us to see the priceless nature of reality. Reality doesn't come with a price tag to it. And that's brought out, I know some of you are taking my Diamond Sutra class. It comes out in a different, slightly different way in the Diamond Sutra, but it's pointing to the same thing. It's all the sections in the Diamond Sutra that have to do with merit. So I'll just give you an example. I pulled one of these out. One of the main characters in the sutra is a gentleman by the name of Subhuti, who was one of Buddha's students. He was a student who actually had deep understanding into the teachings of emptiness. And then Buddha. These are the two interlocutors that are the basically make up the sutra. So this is Buddha talking to Subhuti. He says, Subhuti, if someone made a gift of the seven precious things, and the seven precious things, these again are things that we value. So some of these things we look at now and we go, I guess one of the seven was just crystal, which while it's beautiful and can be expensive, you think of the most precious things, seven precious things, they're jewels and gems, basically. If somebody were to make a gift of the seven precious things equal in amount to all the Sumerus in the 3,000 galaxies of worlds. Okay, so Sumerus are these giant, it's a giant mountain. It's basically the center of the world. Holding up the sky, we can imagine it doing. Just a giant mountain. So if we were to imagine the seven precious things equal in amount to all the Sumerus, all these giant mountains in 3,000 galaxies, all right, of worlds. Now these galaxies have all these solar systems in them, and those solar systems have all these worlds in them, and all these worlds have Sumerus in them, and if we were to take the seven precious things and give a gift that was the equal to all those, as an act of generosity, right? Whew! That's pretty generous, right? And if another were to demonstrate to others just one stanza of four lines of the Diamond Sutra, the merit of the latter would be far greater than that of the former, to the extent, and this is where I'm getting at here, that no conceivable comparison could be made. Because the Diamond Sutra is pointing to reality. Reality is priceless. You can't put a price on it. So Buddha's just giving us these examples that are so friggin' out there, right? That you really can't even fathom it. It's just beyond fathoming to let go of a sense of scale. That's how precious reality is. That's the value of reality. You can't put a price tag on it. It doesn't come that way. So this is the true nature of reality. I mean, you can ask yourself, again, just in this world that we live in, what would be the price of a beam of sunlight? What is the price of smelling the cooking that's going on? You know, what is the price of a scab on your knee? What's the price of that? And once you can start doing that, you can say, what really is the price of anything? Right? You can just take it into that anything. Because we know that anything that shows up is not exactly of the world. The world is of it. As I'm kind of doing a riff on, I'll give you the teaching. So what I'm saying is that we might think that this thing shows up, this thing is of the world, but really it is that the world is it. You know, it's not of this world. It's not in this world. The world is it, showing up as that. Everything that is not that clock is showing up as that clock right now. And we can understand that. Showing up as everything that is not that clock. So if Rick was that clock, then that clock wouldn't be that clock because Rick would be that clock. So everything that's not that thing is right there in that thing. Everything. And again, we can do this in things, but we're talking everything. We're talking about all of reality is showing up as that clock. That's a realization. So remember we talked about Soto, Sozan and Tozan, and Sozan is the head of the dead cat. Tozan has a teaching that I'm kind of stealing and maybe doing a little bit of damage to that you may know, but that's worth repeating here. So Tozan, when he left his teacher Ungan, he asked his teacher, "How is it that you would like me to represent your teachings?" So as Tozan went out into the world, maybe went to other temples to study, he said, "Yeah, I studied with Ungan." You know, we know the story of Gute. We know how he would not want to be represented. His teaching was always this: Gute, nature of reality. Gute, what's the most valuable thing in the world? Gute, what time is lunch? You know, that was his answer. That. And yet, if you were to say, "That was my teacher's teaching," Gute would cut your finger off, as he does in a famous koan. But teachers would often be represented, you know, "That's my teacher," and Ungan's teaching was, so Ungan tells Tozan, "Represent my teachings this way, just this is it." And this became an important teaching for Tozan, actually. We have a book, Just This Is It, which is the teachings of Dongshan. It says that's his Chinese name. And by the way, I would highly recommend that book. It's really excellent, teachings of Dongshan, Tozan. And he takes this teaching of Just This Is It, and at first, he doesn't quite get it. So he knows it's his master's teaching, but he doesn't quite understand the teaching, Just This Is It. But he has an experience that actually opened his heart up to what it was that the teaching was. He was wading through a stream, and he saw his reflection. And right there he had the insight. The insight is, I am not it. So we think about it, reality, enlightenment, that we're trying to go, I am not it, it is me. It's right here. That's his awareness. And so that particular line shows up in a poem that's in our chant book, The Jewel of Mirror Awareness. The Mirror of Jewel Awareness, I guess. Jewel, Mirror Awareness. It's Mirror of Jewel Awareness. But right in there, in that line, we have that insight into Just This Is It. Just this is it. It's right here. What we're calling me is here. So that's our koan. And then Steve starts to talk about this. He says, woe. So remember now, Sozan says, head of a dead cat, because it's something that you can't name its price. And Steve says, woe to those of us who do know the price of things. For we go through life evaluating everything. We put everything and every event on some kind of scale. How good is it? What's it good for? What can I get out of this? What's in it for me? At the same time we do all this, we're miserable, unhappy, wanting, greedy, begging, scheming. We're dissatisfied yet have no clue about what our problem is. We see no connection between our endless evaluating and our recurring unhappiness. And so already we're reaching for the next thing and the next and the next and the next. Meanwhile, we miss the most valuable thing in life. Over and over again, we keep making the same mistake. What we really want out of life is not something that can be obtained in this way. Actually, I'm just going to pause there. We'll end with over and over again, we keep making the same mistake of evaluating, of pricing, of thinking that something has more value than something else or something has less value. And again, that's what we do. So we ask ourselves, how good is this? We want the best thing. We want the good thing. If it's not good, we don't want it. Which is interesting, because it's true. If it's not good, we don't want it. Who wants something that's not good? I'd say Suzuki Roshi did. There's a story about Suzuki. Go to a vegetable mart. So Shinryu Suzuki, the Japanese Zen teacher who founded the San Francisco Zen Center, is living in, well, the center, I think, at that time is in its current location. And there was a vegetable stand nearby. And he would always go and find the piece of vegetable, fruit, whatever it was, that was rotten. And he would buy it. And so finally, the vendor just said, well, I don't know if you call him Roshi, you know, sir. Sir, every time you come here, you buy the worst piece of fruit that I have. He goes, I have other stuff, I could sell you that. And Suzuki said, well, if I didn't buy it, who would? Who would buy this? So he would buy it, and he just cut the rotten part off and eat the rest of it. And it's not saying that's what you need to do in life, but just notice, that's what we do. We don't want the things that we've valued less. We want the better thing. So maybe we're even at this fruit stand, and all the fruit just looks kind of mediocre to us. You know, maybe we're afraid we're going to have that experience. If you ever saw the episode of Seinfeld where Kramer, like, gets a, I don't know if it's cantaloupe or a muskmelon, but it's some melony kind of thing that can, you know, if you've ever had those kind of melons, at least for me, there's like a tiny window of time where it's actually edible, and then the rest of the time I can't. And sure enough, Kramer takes a big spoon of it and he's spitting it out of his mouth, right? So maybe we're afraid we're going to get that experience. It's just not going to be edible in our impression. And there we go then, got to go to a different fruit stand. And maybe that one's a mile away. So now you got to go traipsing around looking for that better thing. So again, that's what happens when we start asking how good is it. And we do it all the time. So again, what we really want to see is we're doing that right now. Right now you're doing that thing that you do. And I think about this. Now when I could ask you, instead of what's the most valuable thing in the world, who is one of the best rock bands of all time? And you would say, well, Steve, clearly that was the Ramones. And I would say, you're absolutely right. And when the Ramones started out, You know what kind of speakers they used? What's that? What kind? No, not Tower Power. They used whatever speakers made sound. That was it. That was the value. They just wanted to play music. They didn't care about sound quality. They just wanted to play music. So we wouldn't have the Ramones if they would have been looking around looking for the Tower of Power. You know, they wouldn't have happened because they didn't have the money to buy that stuff. And then Steve has this other series of questions too. You know, what's it good for? To me, these are all kind of related. What's it good for? What can I get out of this? What's in it for me? And I would say that this is, say, the disease, but the unsettledness of this culture we have that prides itself in a way on pragmatism. Now, I put that pragmatism in quotation marks. What's it good for? You know, what can I get out of this? I was just talking to somebody recently, and he was really bothered by the word right in the Eightfold Path. So right speech and right action. He goes, wouldn't it be better? He goes, right is a problem. Because who knows what's right or what's wrong? He goes, wouldn't it be better if he said helpful? Helpful speech and helpful action. And I actually told him, I said, well, they are synonyms if you're looking at it from the right perspective. But if you're not, then no. Helpful is not a better word, because we often think it's got to help me somehow, right? So we come to this practice, going, well, something's going to happen, right? I know people have been practicing for a long time, and they go, now, really, though, really, it gets better, right? I mean, you're going to, whatever it is. You know, it's this pragmatism. I had two majors when I was an undergraduate. I started out as a music major. And then when I was almost done with that degree, I decided to start working on what I thought was going to be my minor, which was theater. I didn't connect the two. I wasn't going into musical theater. I loved music. And I was interested in theater. And so I thought, I'll get a minor in that. And then I started taking some theater classes and went, wait a minute, I like this better than I like the music stuff. So I'm going to finish that music degree and I don't know what I'm doing with my life anyhow. I'll just get a theater degree. So liberal arts education, that's what I had, where you question things and you embody things and you imagine and you do that kind of work. Look what's happening to it in this culture. There are programs in major colleges and universities right here in Minnesota. You want to look at St. Mary's offerings. See what programs they've cut. No more philosophy there. No more French there. No more history there. Why not? Well, when I told an acquaintance, it was with a friend, and he said, well, let's go see what my friend, I'll call him Jim Bob, I don't remember his name, let's go see what Jim Bob's up to. So we go to Jim Bob and knock on his door. Jim Bob opens the door and, just woke up, I was just sleeping, you know. And then he said something incredibly coarse and vulgar that I couldn't even believe somebody was saying, how I've never met before. And I just went, well, that was interesting. And then he asked me, he goes, Steve, what's your major? And I said, oh, yeah, I'm a music major. That's what I was at that time. And he said, what corporation are you going to work for with that? That was what I was already encountering in college. And that's the way college is presented, is this pragmatism. What do you get out of it? And for me now, especially as an English, you know, then I went to graduate school in English on top of it to make matters worse. But I was trying to help people to see that reducing life to what you're going to get out of it, reducing life to some kind of job, not that jobs aren't important, but reducing your whole life, all of life to that, how sad. And that music and literature and theater and film and whatever it is, that stuff has value, because when it really plumbs the depths, when you're talking the Adagio movement from Beethoven's 15th string quartet, wow. I mean, that's pointing at the goods. You know, there's true nature showing up in the experience of that music. But we want to get something out of it. And we go, well, you know, you say you got that great aesthetic experience out of it. I suppose you could say that. But that's what we do. We want to know what it is we get out of things. You know, so with Zazen, with this practice, you might hear the teaching, Zazen is useless, or this practice is useless. And people go, well, you can't mean that. It has to have some kind of benefit to it. Well, does it? What is going on when we're sitting Zazen? And that's what Sesshin is an invitation to do. What is going on right now? What is this? Are you just working your way into some other state of mind? So what we do then is, as Steve points out, let's see, where did I move ahead here? He points out that when we do this, when we're constantly thinking about how good is it, or what's it good for, or what can I get out of this, or what's in it for me, what we don't realize is how difficult we're making our life for ourselves. He says we're miserable, we're unhappy, we're wanting, greedy, begging, scheming. And he says we don't even see the connection between our endless evaluating and our recurring unhappiness. And I would even say that there's a sense sometimes that people have of their not even being miserable or unhappy or wanting or greedy or begging. Because it might be we're going, you know what? Sometimes I feel all right. You know, I feel pretty content with the way things are. You're telling me that I'm unhappy and miserable and greedy because I'm evaluating. But we're usually content until we're not. I mean, that's just the simple truth of the way reality shows up. We are happy until we're not. We're content until we're not content anymore. So maybe, I don't know if this would give you that kind of pleasure, but that shirt you always like to wear gets a hole in the elbow and you can't wear it anymore. It just tears apart. Or that pie. I had a friend who bought a pie. I don't know, this place is like the best pie. So getting back to our evaluations, right? The best pie in the Twin Cities. And you gotta enter a lottery to get one of these pies, and she won the lottery that particular week. She was coming to my house for dinner, and I just went, oh, good. And it was pretty good. So maybe you're content because that pie is pretty good, but then the pie is eaten. Then you go, need another pie. So right there, we're back to it again. Or you think about a relationship and your significant other changes. They change. What the hell did they do that for? And you're changing as well. So then we're right back to where we are, that misery, that unhappiness, not realizing that that contentment came from we wanted the best, the thing that's giving us whatever, the bump. You know, that's the thing we're looking for. And now that thing's not giving it to us anymore for one reason or another. So we don't even realize the state that we're moving in, which is to always be looking for that sense of that sense of happiness, that sense of well-being, that sense of peace, which of course the implication is what? That you're unhappy, that you're not peaceful if you're always looking for it. So those two are connected. And again, even if we feel, you know, again, I'll hear people say, look, I'm not miserable, I'm not dissatisfied all the time. But I'm just pointing out to you that even when you're satisfied, that bump is still there, often motivating what you're doing in the moment. So I think about if you are right here and something fantastic happens. So I'll just say, like, the first time that I saw the Grand Canyon, which was about 5 years ago, actually. And, you know, I'd seen pictures of the Grand Canyon. But that's not like being in the presence of the Grand Canyon. And so there I am. And, you know, something happens when, you know, it doesn't necessarily happen, but right there you are. There's something about the Grand Canyon especially that just cuts through time. It's just right there. And what do? Wow. You know, so that wow in some fashion is an expression of that, but it's fill in that. It's just the need to put something there. Woohoo! That might be on our, to whip the camera out. I didn't get it. I'm going to get this. And then you look back at your pictures. I mean, I do that. I'm such a terrible photographer. I look at my pictures and I go, what? I don't even know what that is. What is that thing? You know, but it never seems to capture what it is I thought I was capturing by taking the picture. Why am I taking that picture? I want to capture it. I want to have it. So right there, even in the happiness, is that expression of that unsatisfactory feeling that we have. So Steve continues. He says, what we really want out of life is not something that can be obtained in this way. It's not a commodity that can be bought and sold. For that matter, it's not even an it. The most valuable thing in life, I love, he says this, he goes, which incidentally is not literally the head of a dead cat. So in case you were all thinking that's really what Sozan was saying, he says, which incidentally is not literally the head of a dead cat. The most valuable thing in life is very simple. That's why we miss it so easily. Nevertheless, it's always at hand. What we really want and what is truly priceless. Now, here's a difficulty I have with this chapter because you all want to know what this is now, don't you? Right? So we go, okay, here he goes. He's gonna tell us what it is. He goes, it's to wake up. Now, we'll talk about this, but you might have heard that and just went, that's it. We'll talk about that in a second. But it's to wake up. We want to see. But there isn't any particular thing to see, as if you could grab it or hatch it or put its pieces together. It's not a physical item you can hold in your hand. It's not a mental object you can hold in your mind either. The things we can put price tags on or measure in any other way are precisely not the things our heart sings for, the things we truly, deeply need and want. What we truly, deeply need and want, we already have, and it's priceless. And it's precisely because it's priceless that we tend not to see it. We're too distracted by all the things we do evaluate. We assume that the most valuable thing in the world must look like all the other things we habitually evaluate, only bigger or deeper or prettier or more moving. So what is the most precious thing? It's not a thing at all. It's this very moment. It's this very moment. And when people hear that, I think they just go, yeah, they might not believe it. They might not believe what it is Steve is saying. And that is good. That is real good. Because Steve's not offering this for you to believe. Now he's saying, look at your life. What is it you're doing? And again, you have to do it with open eyes. You can't go, yeah, sometimes I'm happy. You don't really see what's taking place, even in the midst of your happiness. Just be aware. That doesn't mean be miserable while you're happy. I don't know if you can do that. I guess I can. If anyone can figure out how to do it, I've done it. You know, but it's not asking you to do that. It's asking you to just be always aware. And sometimes we can't be, so we're going to get swept away. And when we get swept away at some point, we can, oh, this is what's going on right now. And that's where you are right now. This is what's showing up. So this might be hard for people to believe. That what it is, that the thing I want is to wake up. That's the thing I want out of most out of anything like that. And sometimes if you don't believe it, you reject it. You just go, well, how does he know? Maybe I don't want that, you know, because what does that mean to wake up? Some people might say, I don't want enlightenment. I'm not taking up this practice for enlightenment, which may be true based on why you came to this practice. But then people who take up this practice and hear about enlightenment and then hear that they're not supposed to want enlightenment, they might be going, yeah, I don't want enlightenment. That's not what I want. That's not the thing I want. So you just again, watch that. But if you first came here because maybe, like I did, you didn't want to be anxious all the time anymore, right? What is that? So what is that? You know, that ultimately is the desire to wake up. And that's, we have difficulty seeing that because you can't get rid of your anxiety by, I don't know, getting rid of your anxiety. You know, you can't do that. You can try really hard, but it's difficult to do. It's sort of like, I'll say sort of like, but it's sort of like when I was smoking, you know, and I smoked, I don't know. It always varied because I quit so many times. I gotta stop smoking. I'd stop smoking for a couple weeks or a couple months. One time it was 5 years. I quit smoking for 5 years and then started smoking again. And I can't tell you the feeling that I had when I started smoking again. It was actually twofold. It was elation, like, oh my God, it feels so good. And it was also just utter shame. It was just utter shame. Oh my God, I'd made it 5 years. Now here I am just throwing it away, smoking those cigarettes again. Because whenever I tried quitting, that's all that would be on my mind was quitting smoking. It would be like, all right, today I'm only going to have 5 cigarettes. 5. That's hard. If you're smoking a pack a day, that's 20 cigarettes. You know. So see, you can see that's the kind of math I would do that stuff. I'd be like, okay, so it's 1/4 of what you usually smoke. And you usually smoke on the way to work. And then you smoke at your morning break. And you smoke at lunch. And then you smoke in the afternoon break. And then you smoke on the way home. And so then there's your 5 cigarettes, 1 at each spot, you know. And then you go, okay, 2 more hours to my next cigarette. I don't know. It made it really difficult. When you do things like that, when you try to get rid of the thing, it's like try not to think of an elephant. There it is. It's just going to be there, you know. So that's not really how we do it. We want to wake up. We actually want to see what's actually taking place. The anxiety will take care of itself. The smoking will take care of itself. The procrastinating snacking will take care of itself if you just immerse yourself in what it is that's showing up right now. You know, you say, well, right now I yearn to have those peanuts or whatever it is. But do you? Is that really what's going on? What is taking place? Oh, you don't want to write that letter. That's what it is. Now you can really see what's going on. So, again, what Steve's helping us to see is we really want to see what it is that's showing up. We really want to be fully living this moment so we can really see what's taking place rather than these solutions we have to take care of something. Thinking that what we really want is to wake up might seem disappointing. There was somebody at the last session. He even put it differently than disappointing. He said tragic. You know, when I hear these teachings, when I come to a session and I hear these teachings, he was like tragic. Because all the things that he desires, it sounds like he realizes or he's hearing they're not going to make him happy. All the things that went into creating his identity, they don't matter the way he thinks they matter. You know? So the teaching again is not telling you to give that stuff up. It's not saying give up your dreams of becoming a writer. You want to write? Write. But realize that writing, if that's what it is. You see, I'm talking about all my obsessions, eating peanuts and smoking cigarettes and writing. But whatever it is, you know, is not going to make you happy. It's not the thing that's going to do it. And boy, I realized that. I remember hanging out with friends and we were all, you know, fans of this writer and that writer and this actor and that actor. And we just went, you know, all the guys are kind of our cultural heroes. How come they're all alcoholics? Every last one of the people we listed were alcoholics. We were just like looking at ourselves going, at a bar, sitting at a bar, talking about our heroes, having another scotch, you know. Oh, yeah, and then they're all alcoholics. Why are they all alcoholics? Well, why do you think? What's going on there? It's a good question. It's something to pay attention to. You know, so it can cause us pain. Or, as I said before, when we hear what you really want to do is wake up, is then we might make something of it. Oh, yeah, that's what I want. That he's right. That is the thing I want. I want to wake up. So we take up this practice to wake up. That's why we do it. Not doing it for that. What on earth am I doing it for? To get rid of your anxiety or to get rid of your depression or to, I don't know, fill in the blanks, whatever it is. But the thing we want to realize, and one of the things that Steve points out to us, is that this waking up is not a thing. He says it's not an it. And, it's not a commodity that can be bought or sold. It's not a thing. It's not an it. So there's nothing for us to get. That's the nature of things that is so maddening, is there it is and it looks like we can get it. Even if it's an idea about something, it seems like, well, I can do that. I was looking through some, I have these little notepads because writing is what I do. I haven't made any money doing it really. Well, I've made some money, but not really any, you know. And so I write constantly. I'm writing ideas down in notebooks. And I picked one up the other day and I went, huh. Play idea. And then I read the play idea and I went, I could still write that. I could still write that. You know? So, an idea that we have, we still think we can get that thing. Not paying attention to what's really going on here. And what is this going on here? Well, this. This is what's going on. Right here and right now. So nowhere else. Right here. No, anywhere else is just an idea. This is it. Right here. No when else? No when else. It's just an idea. Does that mean you can't have those ideas? No, but realize it's just an idea. It is this, and it doesn't get any better than this. Remember, each cut of meat is the best. Everything is doing its best. This moment is the best. It's the best. Why? Because it can't get any better than this. Here it is. How is it going to be any different than it is right now? You could start imagining, well, it would be a lot better if I was sitting on a beach drinking a beer. Whatever it is. Again, there I'm going. I don't really like sitting on beaches, to be honest. So it would be like, there I am sitting on a deck beside a lake reading some poetry, drinking a beer while I listen to Ornette Coleman. There you go. A lot of my obsessions right there. But you could imagine that, but here this is. Here this is. And I'll tell you right now, I'm out there reading that book, and then tree frogs start pooping on my book, and some of the joy goes out of it. Oh, no, I just bought this book. I paid $70 for it, and it just pooped on my book. Oh, no. Or the time I left my book outside, and then I didn't realize I left it outside. I set it somewhere, and then somebody moved it. So I thought they put it in the house, and then it rained that night. And then the next day I got up, and I had a little pocketbook of Zen teaching. So how appropriate was this? It was waterlogged. It was just a little, like a little sponge. But there it is. That's what reality was at that time. The little sponge. I could just enjoy the liquidness of that book at that time. I ain't going to get any better than this. This is the way it is. It is this. I remember Steve Hagen. I know I've told this before, but it was so moving to me, and it so got to the heart of what these teachings are pointing out. It was not long after Steve's wife had passed away, and Steve was sitting here in meditation. And one thing that meditation teachers, you probably notice I face this way. You guys all have to face the wall, and then I face up this way. And it's not for any other reason. In part, it's I'm watching. So in regular everyday meditation, sometimes somebody will come and they'll never have meditated before. And I can tell it by a lot of ways. The way they enter the room, for example, as they walk across the middle of the room would be another example of it, not knowing to stick inside the cushions. And then I watch them sit down and they sit on their feet, like this, but on their feet, like when you're a kid and you're taught how to sit Indian style, like that. And I go, whoa, they are not going to be able to sit like that for very long. I know, I just know. So I watch and I go, okay, when it gets to be unbearable for them, I know that sounds cruel, but I actually think this is the best, this is the opportunity then to instruct otherwise. Otherwise, you're just intruding, you know. So when it becomes unbearable and you start noticing them constantly moving around, then I might sit next to them and actually just show them how to sit on the cushion. And then I sit next to them, you know, so I can see what's going on. So sometimes the teacher, we sit this way to provide teaching. We're just by sitting, we're teaching. But sometimes you might have to give some extra instruction. And the teacher could just say something out loud. And Steve did. So this was shortly after Gene had passed away. And what he said was, it doesn't get any better than this. I just remember that really touched me. Because you knew he was had to have been sad and grieving. But that's life. Life has grief in it. Life has pain in it. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us. You know, she just broke that wrist shortly before Sashin. And I was concerned. I just thought, I hope she can do it. So I'm so glad you're here. But life has breaks in it. That's what happens. So people say, how come, if what you're saying is true, how come I'm just not awake to the fact that we are here in enlightenment? Well, it's because, as Steve points out, we miss it because, well, a part of it's we don't think it's enough. We go, yeah, it could be better than this, you know. But part of it's just it's so simple. You know, it's just this right here. Right? This is something I'll be talking about more tomorrow. It's just here. It's so obvious. It's as obvious as this. You know, it's obvious. It's so obvious that we just look right past it. Just look right past it. It can't possibly be that, the most valuable thing in the world, that. It's just this. You know, it's so we overlook it because we're thinking, as Steve points out, it's somehow got to be better, right? It has to be better. It has to be more this than this, because this can't be it, but this is it. And so you can start to see again that what's really driving that is that unsatisfied sense. So we go out and we look outside of what's showing up. Now it could be that this hurts. And this is why. How could it not be any better? Just pay attention to what's going on. I wanted to close with a passage from Returning to Silence that we just talked about in discussion group. And it you know, I'd read it. I marked it. Like when you look at the book of my book, it's, you know, underlined. So at some point in my life, I went, this is valuable. This is the most valuable thing in the world. But, you know, I underlined it because it was so, it seemed like it really got spot on. Partly to how it is that we miss what's going on, and it's even what it is that's going on, and how we can't really avoid that. So Katagiri said, but remember, in the deepest reaches of human life, there's still a vague, disconsolate pain or unsatisfactory feeling there. So I was talking about, even when you're satisfied, it's there. A disconsolate pain or an unsatisfactory feeling. It's very difficult to be free from this pain. It's not exactly pain, but a kind of silent lamentation inside. This is always there. Remember, this is why Buddha says life is characterized by suffering. This suffering is not the usual sense of suffering. It is quite different. There is no other way to experience this really deep suffering. And this is going to point to something else he was talking about in the chapter. But there's no way to experience this really deep suffering without the three flavors of optimism, things are great. Pessimism, things suck. Or mysticism, kind of understanding that things are great and things suck and kind of transcending that. Getting that moment where you go, oh, yeah, yeah. So you can't experience this deep suffering without those three flavors. Without, it's great, it's terrible, it's something else. It's a chorus. Ah, you know, it's hallelujah chorus or whatever. This is silence seen from the viewpoint of human eyes. So that disconsolate suffering, that thing that's always there, it's only there while we see through human eyes. While we see this way, we see through Buddha's eyes, the suffering we can be released from it. But only if we go through it. This is of the utmost importance. You can't go around it. You can't avoid it. You have to see it. You have to realize it is your experience. As a human, that it's there, you have to see it. And then you can see that it's nothing in particular. It doesn't have to grip you the way it is. It's nothing in particular. But you have to see that that is the framework. It's this, that sense of the most valuable thing in the world driving us at the heart. It's that pain. It's that suffering. Does that mean you're walking around in pain and misery? No. Again, it's different. He even tells us it's different. But it is that unsettledness. We always want to put something there, take a picture of it. We want to hang on to it, whatever it is. Woohoo! You know, whatever it is. We want to do that. Or, that was perfect. I remember Norm talking about it. I can't remember if Norm smoked or not. But I think he was talking about that, lighting up a perfect day. Light up a cigarette to kind of put a cap around it. Oh, yeah. This is good. You know, it's something like that that we do. That comes from not seeing. Again, what Steve says, what we don't realize is that our suffering comes from not seeing that our desire to evaluate and make things better and look for the best thing, look for the goods, look for something I can get from it, that it's that and our sense of trying to be happier, trying to be at ease, trying not to be depressed, trying to, whatever it is, trying to be the best at something, that these two come together. Right. So this is where I'm going to stop with this chapter. Next time I'll finish the chapter. So, do people have questions or comments?
Head of the dead cat is something you would never normally be evaluating.
Yeah.
That seemed like it was a poignant teaching.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Thanks. Absolutely. Yeah, it puts you right past that zone. It's so something you wouldn't even associate with value of any kind. I mean, you wouldn't even, I suppose you'd go like, well, that's valueless, right? And that's kind of the point, right? It's to get you into that place. So that's right. And Shinshin Ming has got great teachings about trusting the heart mind. It's a poem that's in our chant book. And it's an incredible teaching
And we offer a class on it from time to time. I think within the last year or two, we had a class on it. But anyhow, it's a great teaching, and yeah, you're right. One of the things he helps us to see is that way we have of that, you know, that we're doing that at all. We're not really seeing what's directly in front of us. To see what's directly in front of us is for that to just drop away. We don't even have the desire to try to figure out what that cat head is worth. what would that be worth? It just doesn't, the whole idea just is gone. Because you can see the priceless nature of it. Yes, thanks for sharing. All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.